21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Just one key unlocks them both. It's there at your
Hey, welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus, and our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Kortner. Our engineer is Anita Brockington. Having read and reviewed Nicholan Pearson's Crystal Healing of the Heart and the Seven Archetypal Stones, I was most impatient in waiting for the stones of the goddess, for the divine feminine. The wait was, well, it was most worthwhile. Brother Nicholas, believes that widespread acknowledgement, if not outright worship of the divine feminine principle, is necessary for humanity's progress, and that no individual person is wholly masculine or wholly feminine, because we each have a trace of the god and goddess within us. The kingdom of stones has long been associated with the great goddess, and when we hold stones, we are literally holding the body of the goddess, and they become tangible tools for making change in our world by providing us with a link to the immenseness of the divine feminine. Stones of the Goddess not only provides preparatory information on working with crystals from a magical perspective, he also includes hands-on techniques such as cleaning, consecrating, and empowering your favorite tools. It also includes a glimpse at the many roles of the goddess in history. In his compendium of crystals, you will find over 100 entries for various rocks, minerals, fossils, and gemstones. They are all linked to the divine feminine. About this author, Nicholas Pearson, he has been immersed in all aspects of the mineral kingdom for more than 20 years. He began teaching crystal workshops in high school, later studying mineral science at Stetson University while pursuing a degree in music. He worked for several years at the Gillespie Museum, home to the largest mineral collection in the southern United States. A certified teacher and practitioner of Usi Reiki Ryo, he teaches crystal and Reiki classes throughout the United States. He lives in Orlando, Florida, and you can get in touch with him through www.theluminouspearl.com. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio, Nicholas.
Thank you so much for having me. I have been looking forward to this night for a while now.
So have I. So have I. and yet you're going to do other books on other, not just stones, but just about all kinds of other things, which I'm looking forward to. Nicholas, what is your background in crystals?
You know, in brief, since I've done this story on your show before, I was that kid who picked up rocks everywhere. I just had this kinship that I felt with stone, and my grandfather saw this, observed this, and gave me my very first piece of quartz, and that changed my life. I went from just someone who picked up rocks to being a true and proper mineral collector. So I can blame everything. I mean, I can thank my grandfather for this wonderful gift in my life. And it's been like that ever since. I've had this profound love of like every aspect of it, from hard mineral science to the folklore and the mythology that surrounds stones, to, you know, the sort of spiritual symbolism that with which they're imbued, all the way down to the therapeutic context. How can we use them to affect change in our own lives? So I love everything related to rocks.
Well, did your grandfather ever say anything to you about stones and consciousness?
You know, he really didn't. He he was a pretty well-rounded guy. He had the gift of gab and could talk anyone into or out of anything, usually for their own good. And he was such a compassionate and benevolent human being. And I mean, there's not a person on this earth who knew him who wasn't made better by that. But it wasn't really until I was a teenager that he started to share with me any sort of spiritual relationship with the mineral kingdom. And it was probably because I had cultivated it. And I remember maybe as a sophomore in high school, he told me he'd visited a crystal shop without me. Mm-hmm. How dare him, right?
Well, how good do you think he is?
Yeah.
I got carried away.
He fell in love with this crystal. He said it made him burst into tears, and he had no idea why. And he started to have this really profound experience. And it wasn't too much longer before he ended up passing away. But I just remember having this moment with him that was very vulnerable and very touching. And it gave me a sense of validation for my, at the time, just avocation, just this hobby that I had. And here I am all these years later, and it has developed into my career path.
Well, it was my wife, Dr. Queen Zahara, who really taught me and learned from her the fact that animals have consciousness, more than just a little bit of consciousness. I mean, I knew that they were smart, but I had no idea that they really were quite profound thinkers in all kinds of other ways. And then when thinking about stones, I've always been a collector of stones. Of course, I didn't bump into any great gems in any of the alleys that I hung out in when I was growing up. But whenever I saw a particular strange-looking shape or a different color of it, whatever it was, I had to put it in my box and took it home. And, of course, my sisters threw them all away because they were because they were stones. You know, later on, they threw away all my baseball cards, too. So they got back me on that one. Okay, how did you first get involved with the goddess-centered spirituality?
Yeah, so maybe around that same time frame that I was really kind of connecting to crystals in a more spiritualized context, I realized that I'd kind of grown up in a non-religious household. And when other families did church on weekends, my dad and I would go to the library. So, you know, one week I might be learning about minerals, another mm-hmm. week I might be reading fairy tales and folklore. And I started to see these sort of parallels between the two, just two different sets of symbols to describe the same phenomena in the world. And so I really loved exploring, you know, world religion and mythology. And, you know, at the time, growing up as a young gay man without really the language to describe myself from a relationship to the world, I never really... this idea of God the Father who sat on some throne on a cloud in the sky and just stared at us and judged us didn't feel right. And I didn't understand why.
It's not God with love, I'll tell you that.
Right, yeah. And you know, not to discredit all the depictions of a loving God that there are, but it was something that was just missing, something that I felt so disconnected from. Mm-hmm. And then I had the opportunity to, you know, pick up a book on modern neo-pagan witchcraft, and it was like this really salacious thing for me to do as a teenager. I felt super rebellious in Barnes & Noble buying this book on witchcraft. right?
Yeah.
But what ended up happening is that I started to really see the divine in everything around me. You know, those early books I started reading stressed the idea of the immanent divine. You know, divinity was not something far away from us, removed from the equation. It wasn't the clockmaker who made the clock, hung it on the wall, and walked away. It was part of us. And if we start to look at the world around us, if there are so many expressions of life, of love, of everything here on planet Earth, and who knows what's beyond, then how can we limit God to a single face, identity, time frame, skin color, gender expression? If we're all made in the image of God, then, you know, surely God has to be as plural as we are. And that just clicked for me. And it's something that I've stuck with ever since.
That same kind of thing clicked for me especially, but I was basically involved in serving on the altar, because I was moving definitely at one time and becoming a minister or a priest. And until I bumped into the Dead Sea Scrolls and Gnostic teachings, and that just blew me away. Because I had never realized just how much is out there about Jesus Christ and where he lived and what he did during those 30 years, etc. And we weren't getting any real scientific teachings on the spiritual meditation or higher consciousness from my priest or anyone else. And then later on, I found out that they weren't meditating anyway. So that was a real shock to me. But what inspired you to write this book?
You know, I'll be very honest. I had no intentions of writing this book. I can remember very vividly hacking away at the keyboard in front of the computer, working on some revisions for my Reiki book, which was my fourth book, the one that preceded this one in publication. And it was as if I got that gentle little tap from Spirit on the shoulder that said, hey, wouldn't this be a fun idea? Just exploring some correlations between the divine feminine and the mineral kingdom. I thought, yeah, sure, that'd be great. Now let me get back to writing. And this idea was so persistent that I ended up having to just stop what I was doing some days later and just start typing up stream of consciousness. Oh, well, you know, historically this stone is associated with that goddess, and, you know, lapis is, you know, akin to the star goddess or sky goddess Nuit from Egypt. And, you know, I would go through all these things, and I started with things that were obvious from my years of study. And then I started to look for more obscure things, and I started to formulate my own ideas and impressions and correspondences. And that short list kept growing and growing and growing until it eventually formed the basis for what is currently the appendix in the book with all the tables of correspondences in it.
Oh, yes, wonderful.
And from that list, I started to look at some of the most prominent stones and thought, well, maybe I should explore these a little bit further. Maybe this will be more than just a workshop or a fun topic that I can speak on. And it began to take on a life of its own. And at some point, I had to kind of take a step back and say, all right, I'm the scribe here. I'm the author. My name is going to go on the book, but I don't think this is really coming from me. And therefore, to do it justice, I have to do my best to allow that higher power to guide it. Mm-hmm. So although I was the one, you know, cracking open the old books and doing the research and typing away, I really think that the inspiration did not come from me, but through me.
That's the way good books are, especially in this kind of work. Did you ever dream about this during this process when you were, well, especially about the goddess? I mean, did that in any way enter your other lives?
You know, I don't know that I necessarily had a dream about any sort of specific goddess. Mm-hmm. I do a lot of dream work with stones where I'll take them to bed with me and you know, kind of go into that liminal, imaginal state just before I drift off to sleep, and then whatever happens, happens. Mm-hmm. So I would have a lot of really, we'll say, vivid dreams that kind of had thematic statements that might have been relevant to the book, but it wasn't necessarily as if I could just wake up in the morning and say, oh, well, the goddess told me this. Mm-hmm. It was very much the language of symbolism. And if I can be honest, I think that is really the language of the goddess. You know, we have the language of the divine masculine is linear and logical, and it's the language we are communicating with now. But when we go into that sort of opposite polarity, when we move the pendulum to the other end of the scale, the goddess doesn't have to speak through words and signs and symbols that are quite so concrete and discrete. And so to have that really authentic experience was to do it in a very metaphorical fashion, for me at least.
Well, we're going to do a metaphorical faction right now. Taking a break here on 21st Century Radio with our guest, Nicholas Pearson, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine Destiny books. You got to get a copy of this book. You should have gotten every one of his books that we've talked about over the years here on the web at theluminouspearl.com, or find him on Facebook, Twitter, and all social media. And remember, all links are at 21stcenturyradio.com, where our archives are posted weekly for free, as well as on iTunes and on YouTube. Subscribe today and tell your friends.
Thank you. Hello, you're listening to Mayor Cromwell, author of The Great Mother Bible, and it's been a sheer joy to be with Dr. Bob Hieronymus on 21st Century Radio. And if you want to learn about me and my writing, you can go to mayorcromwell.com.
Thank you, Mayor Cromwell. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest Nicholas Pearson. His book is Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine, published by Destiny Books. Nick, how did you select the stones in the compendium?
Oh, this is a good question. In part because some of it was very much like selecting for ease. I saw some stones that kept popping up in myth after myth or seemed to share attributes with many different goddesses. So it was just super easy. Things like moonstone, things like lapis lazuli, even garnet and emerald were like no-brainers. But I wanted to include some newer stones, things that we definitely don't have any ancient literature about because we've only started mining them in the relatively, you know, recent timing in the grand scheme of things. And I wanted to be able to draw conclusions from those newer stones about where we're headed as a human race, where we're going on a planetary level based on the sort of signals in the mineral kingdom. And then, you know, at the end of the day, I wanted to make it a manageable sized book. It's a heavy book as it is. Imagine if there'd been, you know, 300 stones of the goddess instead of 107. So I did have to do some trimming, and I kind of had to stick to some of my favorites. I hate to say it, but some of them are my favorite children more so than others.
Well, we'll find out which ones are some of your favorite ones in a little while, aren't we? I hope so. It's rules and regulations, 506 of the Penal Code. We have to figure that out. Which are your favorite stones for connecting to the goddess? We're going to get to that.
Well, lapis is a really great example.
Yeah.
I have managed to mention lapis in every book I've written, including my Reiki book. There's a brief mention of it. So it's something that I just have this really profound love and appreciation for. But when I really first started doing the work with lapis, it was a hard teacher for me. There is this sort of gravity that it has. And as a connection to the divine feminine, it looks like the night sky. It's, you know, this beautiful ultramarine blue bedecked with pyrite stars and, you know, swirls of calcite and diopside and other minerals that might resemble nebulas or clouds in the sky. And it's just a wonderful stone for perspective, but it also harmonizes the heart and the mind. And, you know, we live in a world, at least in the Western society, that dichotomizes heart and mind and puts them in separate boxes on separate shelves. And, you know, one of the gifts of lapis is the reunification, the restoration of true self as heart and mind as one unified force. And that's something we really have to be in touch with. We can't embrace the divine feminine and divorce ourselves from our emotions at the same time. Another stone that I really adore working with for connecting to the divine feminine is a native element. It's copper. So, you know, copper is usually an igneous mineral. You can find crystals of it. It technically counts as a mineral. But, you know, copper has this really ancient history, a long mythic association with the Great Mother. Some of the most famous and important copper mines of the ancient world were on the island of Cyprus. And it's actually where we get the name copper. So it's a long and circuitous path, but originally copper in Greek was named after Kupros for the name of Cyprus. And this is also the birthplace of the cult of Aphrodite or Venus. And, you know, this is a stone that really is all about integration, connection. One of my dear friends, Barbara Evans, calls it the eternal synergist. It's linking things. So that way by the process of connection, we become greater than ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's the gift of copper. The medieval alchemists also had a kind of a racy nickname for copper. That's one of my favorite little factoids about this crystal. They used to call her Meretrix Metallorum, which roughly translated from Latin means the harlot of metals. You know, it's so scandalous because she never refuses anybody. Copper will willingly become an oxide or a silicate, a salt or a sulfide. She takes many lovers. And not every metal can do that. But, you know, the symbolism here of the divine feminine is that she refuses none of us. If we make the call, it is answered. And it is through that relationship we cultivate with the divine feminine that we are also transformed. You know, if we take some copper and some carbonate and put them together, we have a range of beautiful minerals that can be produced, like malachite or azurite. And, you know, it's something more interesting than just swirling together some copper and carbon and oxygen. And copper is so transformational, and it's so deeply linked to that worship of Aphrodite and Venus, famously. If anyone listening is a fan of classical art, if you see Botticelli's painting of the birth of Venus, there is a hidden reference to copper in this, even though I'm sure Botticelli didn't realize it. But, you know, her name means the foam-born goddess. She was born out of the foam of the sea. And she's riding in this image in a shell. And that organism, that mollusk, has a blue pigment in its blood that it uses to breathe. We have iron-based hemoglobin. But mollusks use something called hemocyanin, which gets its blue color from copper. So here she is, riding on this mollusk, who is, you know, powered by copper, as she's about to set foot on the island of copper, from which we get the name copper. And she is that embodiment of the great cosmic mother. And I think that is just such a clear illustration of how intimately linked this material is to the divine feminine in the ancient world, but also for the reemergence of it today. I mean, all of our wiring, all of our electricity is delivered to us through copper. We use copper for so many things, and it's so underappreciated. And isn't that the story of every woman ever, who is so many things to so many people and so vastly underappreciated?
Well, I did a mural at Johns Hopkins University, and it's called The Apocalypse. And the colors that I used in it were metallic: copper, silver, bronze, and gold. And when you put these elements together, of course, those people who have studied Atlantis realize that those are the metals that were so important to Atlantis. And actually, the way they built some of their temples, etc., just extraordinary from that standpoint. So I've always loved copper, and but it's, you know, it's hard to find when you're in buying, say, for instance. I was at a place to where I was buying some stones yesterday, and I could not find hardly any copper at all. And it's just not as available as I thought. You've been able to find other stones, metals, much more rapidly than those. And so there's a great mystery about copper, as far as I'm concerned.
There really is.
And I don't know what it is, but I just feel it. You know what I mean? So being an artist, you know, I feel it. I can't necessarily analyze it.
Yeah, I totally understand that. In my early days in college, when I started my job at the Gillespie Museum, an earth science museum here in Central Florida, that's home to this fabulous mineral collection, I knew a thing or two about rocks before I showed up, but maybe just a thing or two. And then I got to, you know, dive into the collection firsthand. And the thing that amazed me was the sheer variety of copper-based minerals and copper-bearing compounds. And so my first official duty when I was given the title of museum preparator, I got to take an old exhibit that wasn't being used very well, lots of dead space in it, and I made a suite of copper minerals. And I found things that I could barely pronounce then, might still not do a great job of today. But copper is really, really transformational. And we see that just with how beautiful and how extraordinarily vivid the minerals are that are formed from it.
But why is it so important to connect to the divine feminine?
Well, you know, we definitely live in a time of imbalance, we could say. We have witnessed the swinging of the pendulum toward the divine masculine for a little too long. And the version of that divine masculine that we've seen portrayed by most of the spiritual leaders of the world, I certainly can't say for everybody, but for a lot of the world's traditions, is one that is fragmented. It is incomplete. And he's missing his consort. We have to recognize that, you know, if we as human beings are expressions of the divine, and we're plural, so too is the divine in some sense or another. I believe that we as human beings are maybe a little too small to really conceive of everything the divine can be. And so we personify it, we personalize it, we make it available to us in a way that we can digest. And so we break down this great big cosmic everything into faces, names, stories that we can relate to. And as we've begun to forget or mythologize and take the stories of the divine feminine less seriously over time, we've really created imbalance in the world. And, you know, what we see prevalent in our approach to religion and spirituality as a whole is indicative of something much deeper. There's a great sickness in the world when we are as a whole not empowering women, not standing behind women, not standing with people of color, with immigrants, with minorities. We're all children of the Great Mother. We're all children of Mother Earth. I mean, we personify our planet as feminine. It's hard not to make the leap between crystals and the divine feminine here. But when we kind of get into this place of imbalance, we need to push the pendulum back in the other direction. And so I think that's why this is such a hot topic these days. It's why we've got so many people who are teaching things that relate to the divine feminine, to the goddess. It's why we've got this wonderfully fierce and intersectional wave of feminism that is spreading around the world. You know, the goddess has heard our call, and it is through our actions that she is made manifest.
Thank you. Obviously, I think that that's more than true. I think it's really some of the keys to how in the world, if we don't return to balance, we are headed for death. It's no two ways about it. And unfortunately, there are some people that don't give a damn about that. And so we're going to see a lot of lost lives with all the floods that are coming. I'm just amazed that some people have not come to realize it, that our winters are not like our winters before, our summers are not like our summers, and it's going to continue this way, which means we're going to have problems with our crops and eating and all the basic things of life. Oh, excuse me, I guess I shouldn't have gotten into that aspect of it, but I think it's important.
It's appropriate.
Well, unfortunately, there's not enough people that are conscious enough of what's going on to talk about this. And you don't have many on radio at all. Most of them are scared to death about this and absolutely refuse to even accept part of it. We have had a lot in Baltimore from that standpoint. What goddess-related myth about a crystal or gemstone is your favorite?
This is something that has kind of evolved over time for me. There are a lot. It started probably like the whole myth linking Aphrodite and copper and Cyprus was really near and dear to my heart. But as I've taken the finished book into the world and connected to audiences and really seen the state of the world, to just put it vaguely, the myth of Medusa has really become this sort of emblem of the fierce divine feminine that really speaks to me and that I've been really grateful to be able to share with others. So, you know, in short, we have this beautiful woman who is, on her way to make her supplication at the temple of Athena. And whether it was a consensual advance or not, something untoward happened between her and Poseidon. And, you know, that's the kind of activity that wasn't really cool in said temple. So, you know, there are different interpretations of this myth, but in most of them, she's punished for being weak enough to allow this horrible thing to happen to her, because, you know, we always blame the victim, right?
Right.
And so Medusa is transformed into this hideous figure, this serpent-like creature, banished to an island with the rest of the Gorgons, and any man that she should lay her eyes upon is turned to stone. And so already we've got this connection to stone. But, you know, this serpent is a symbol of rebirth. It's a long-time symbol of the chthonic aspect, the sort of deeper earth aspect of the Earth Mother. And so when we see this sort of battle between the masculine and the feminine, it's a parable for the way the patriarchy has raped and pillaged the earth and taken over the goddess-centered religions and kind of pushed them out. But at the end of the myth, after Medusa is slain, we see that when her severed head is placed at the seashore, her blood leaks through the sac and petrifies some coral, or petrifies some seaweed, and it's transformed into red coral, stained by her blood and turned into stone. And although this is a myth connecting a particular, we'll say gem, although not really a crystal in a classical sense, to the divine feminine, it's a very warlike stone. This is a stone associated with Mars in planetary astrology, both mm-hmm. Eastern and Western. It's very warlike. It's about victory. It's about rising up and having the strength to do things. And this is the energy we need in the world today. If I could give every woman a piece of red coral, of course, ethically harvested, maybe even fossilized red coral, so as not to put a strain on our oceans, I certainly would. I just love this sort of mythic representation of how, in one sense or another, the divine feminine is living on. And that head of the Gorgon is taken back by Athena and placed on her shield as an emblem of that power that's there. And I would love us all to be able to reclaim the power of the divine feminine.
Thank you. And right now we're going to take another break here on 21st Century Radio. What kind of a necklace do you think I'm wearing right now?
Ooh, can I meditate on it over the break?
Sure, you meditate it over the break. And,
all right.
And if you guess it, then we'll give you something special. Maybe a,
sure.
Maybe a punch in the nose or something. No. It's like I've known you forever. Okay, guys. Break time on 21st Century Radio with our guest Nicholas Pearson, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine, Destiny Books, one of my favorite publishers in the whole wide world. You can find them on Facebook, Twitter, and all social media. Go to theluminouspearl.com. Well, there she was. She's at it again. Teaching us all about consciousness and animals. That's the queen. Hey, how would you like to win a free copy of the book we're talking about? Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine by Nicholas Pearson, courtesy of Destiny Books. If you know the answer to this hour's trivia question, you will win that book. Do you know who my final guest is? Was the last time I hosted 21st Century Radio. Tell us who my final guest was on 21st Century Radio, the last time I hosted it. Then you will be our winner, and you need to qualify, and here's how to do that. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio, and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680, that's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
Hi, I'm Glenn Kreisberg, author of Spirits in Stone and co-founder of the Overlook Mountain Center in Woodstock, New York, overlookmountain.org. And you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Keep listening.
Well, thank you. Well, welcome back to 21st Century Radio with our guest, Nicholas Pearson. The big question, and if you can answer this one, you'll win a free Jaguar. Would you like a new Jaguar?
Who wouldn't, right?
Well, okay, all right. Now, let's go for it. It's going to be a hard one. How did you come up... Oh, that's right. I'm in the wrong. I was having such a... Yes, all right. All about the necklace, yes. That necklace that you were talking about?
Yeah. So...
Yeah, okay.
If I were to guess what necklace you might be wearing...
Yeah.
You know, I'm tempted because you asked me that right after I was talking about coral, that I might suggest coral.
You got it!
All right.
You got it right. Red coral. Oh, goodness gracious. This has got about 50 stones red mixed in with the turquoise. When you see that, that's a wonderful combination. And it's nothing like it. And I have been wearing it. Sometimes I wear it to bed. Sometimes I do. Well, yeah. It energizes me. It energizes me a great deal. especially then. Well, I guess we got to get serious now. How did you come up with the sample rituals, spells, and meditations in the book?
So this was kind of like the most fun part of the book to write for me. I really enjoyed the more scholarly research that went into like diving into the myths of the divine feminine, the relationships in the Null Kingdom. But, you know, all of that is well and good, but we have to make it actionable, right? We have to do something so people can use this information.
Yeah.
So some of these sample rituals and other activities in the book are like straight out of my practice, maybe modified slightly so they're in a more public format. But you know, a lot of the actual recipes came from kind of meditating on themes. You know, if I was going to come up with an elixir to connect to the energy of love, I didn't just pick any old stones that represent love. I would meditate on, you know, the goddess Venus or Aphrodite and allow her to guide me to the stones that went in. When it came to the grids, I tried to really think of what are some iconic symbols that we can create, almost like mandalas or sigils that are made out of gemstones. And so I tried to remain open to that divine mystery, that beautiful inspiration, although some of it surely was kind of laid by the foundation of my personal practice that I've been building over the last couple decades.
Which personal practice is that? Is it not your... excuse me, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's there are a lot of different practices in my toolkit. So, you know, I'm an avid crystal grid maker. I use them for a lot of different things. You know, at present moment, I'm studying modern traditional witchcraft with the Temple of Witchcraft. My teacher is Christopher Penzack. So that's been a huge thing that has shaped my practice over the past couple of years in particular. But it's something that is almost a throwback to the thing that got me started in the realm of all things mystical and magical when I found those early books on witchcraft and discovered the goddess. So, you know, over the intervening years, I've really kind of learned a lot of different things and I've worn a lot of different hats, but they've all surely participated in the sort of background work that went into writing this book, as well as all my other books.
Well, I hope you just keep it up and knock out another 10 or 15 books creating libraries of this material, which are very important. We've just begun getting permissions from various prisons. Prisoners really can enjoy a great deal in relearning things that they never even heard about. And that's one of the reasons why we'd like to send libraries of books to prisons. But it's hard to do because many of the people that are controlling the prisons, when they hear anything esoteric, as far as they're concerned, it shouldn't be there. So it's very unfortunate, but it is changing. And it's made a world of differences between the few people that I've worked with in prisons. What are the most important stones for reclaiming the divine feminine today?
Well, you know, I think red coral would be a great one for reasons we've already discussed.
Yeah.
another one that I just absolutely adore for this idea of reclamation of the divine feminine is chrysocolla.
Chrysocolla. So,
Yeah. You know, that beautiful kind of turquoisey blue color leaning into green. It's another copper-based stone. It's got a really complex composition that's actually still debated by some scientists. But, you know, chrysocolla, the name of it comes from Greek, as do so many rocks. And it comes from the words chrysos, meaning gold, and choline, to glue or to stick together. And so we don't know exactly what the Greeks did with this stone, or even if it was the same stone we call chrysocolla today, but they managed to extract the metal content from it and use it as a very special kind of gold solder. So they could take broken bits of gold and stitch them back together. Now, if we look at sort of planetary astrology, gold is the planetary metal of the sun, and the sun in many systems is sort of that cosmic male principle.
Yeah.
And in today's world where we see the broken and fragmented divine masculine, the idea of chrysocolla as representing that feminine Venusian copper-based energy shows us that it's here to stitch things, to heal things, to bring them back together. This is the work of the goddess. That's not to say it's women's work. It's everybody's work. We are all divine feminine. We are all divine masculine. We are all personally victims by victims of the patriarchy, whether we're aware of it or not.
Yeah.
Chrysocolla can allow us to do the internal healing work that allows us to heal that, but it also might empower us to use our voice in ways that we can speak up for the greater world and help to effect that change through connection on a bigger and better level. We don't really do service to humanity by calling out the things that are wrong and ostracizing the people doing the wrong things. We only heal by becoming more inclusive, radically inclusive. And that's the energy of the goddess. And that's why I think that Chrysocolla is such an apposite stone for the time in which we live. It is the stone of the muse. It inspires us in ways we can't dream of.
Well, my wife and I, before we were married, traveling down to North Carolina to see some of my friends and go to some places where we could buy some stones. And the first thing we got that I fell in love with, we both fell in love with, was a huge piece of Chrysocolla. And the strange thing about it is as we went to purchase this stone, the individual that was selling it to us had just had his finger cut off, or one part of it. Which was just horrendous, but somehow this farmer, and actually he more than a farmer, but he somehow held himself together during that particular process, and so that he could heal and part himself. And but that stone, Chrysocolla, I found to be, it's kind of a greenish blue, and it is it's just miraculous as far as I'm concerned. We got one piece of Chrysocolla, which has to be about 60 pounds. That's my most favorite Chrysocolla.
Wow.
You got a bigger one than that?
I sure don't. You've got me beat.
Okay. Well, Chrysocolla, I never thought anyone would be talking about that on the radio. You probably didn't either, except for yourself, huh?
Right, yeah. I'm grateful to hear your stories with it. Thank you.
Well, I learned a lot from you, and I learned a lot from my. I think I'm mostly a student of just about everything, and that's one of the reasons why I like living. Could you tell us about the five essential crystal functions that you describe in part one of Stones of the Goddess?
Very happily. So, I fancy myself at least a science enthusiast, since I'm not a proper scientist. And when I try to really look for the mechanisms at play with how and why crystals work, I try to go back to their physical, their optical, their mechanical, their chemical properties. And if we kind of look at how these materials interact with energy in a physical and physics-based way, they become metaphors for how it works in every other way. So those five essential crystal functions that I've been able to distill over the years are: crystals are oscillators. They are able to send and receive by vibrating at very precise levels. So they become receiver transmitters. So like antennas. They are harmonizers. They have the ability to cohere things. And the hallmark of crystallinity, anything that is crystalline, whether it is a proper mineral or gemstone, or the crystalline substances in our body, is the idea of coherency, having all of the pieces synchronized, organized, and marching in step. And so when something is physically that coherent, energetically, it is similarly coherent, and it draws things into resonance. It encourages things around it to become more coherent themselves. Crystals also work as prisms and lenses. In a classical piece of quartz, we definitely see that prismatic shape. And if you hold a nice clear quartz crystal in bright sunlight, you'll see it make rainbows. When we polish it, it becomes a profoundly powerful lens. And that's actually something I describe in my first book. In chapter 6 of the 7 Archetypal Stones, I go really deep into that symbolism of the prism and the lens, or the wand and the lens. But even in opaque and sub-translucent stones, we see similar ways that crystals interact with other forms of light. You know, light is not just the stuff we see, but it's that whole electromagnetic spectrum. They give us the ability to condense, to focus, to reflect, to redirect, to refract light and energy, and therefore consciousness. They're also translators. So if we look at quartz again as our example, quartz has this really fun property called piezoelectricity. So it comes from the Greek word piezine, which means to squeeze. So when we take certain types of crystal structures and we compress them or otherwise stress them out in a mechanical sense, they maintain a sense of balance and integrity by allowing energy to flow through them. They actually generate an electrical charge under stress. And so it's translating this mechanical energy into electricity. And the same thing happens in reverse in our watches and our clocks that, you know, we see the little word quartz on the faces of these things. It's because there's a little teeny sliver of quartz that gets zapped with the power source and begins to wiggle. It oscillates, it vibrates. So it's converting electricity into mechanical energy as well. But they can translate in so many ways. They're able to take that inner dialogue, that inner realm that we've got, and translate it into the language the universe speaks. You may or may not have noticed this, but the universe doesn't necessarily speak English or Japanese or German or any other synthetic language. The universe speaks in terms of frequency and amplitude and wavelength. And so crystals become our translators between how we conceive of things and think of things and how the universe does, so we can make change happen. And probably most famously of all, crystals are recorders. They have the ability to store information or energy. Little tiny defects in crystal lattices create these little gaps where things can get trapped. That's why we have quartz that comes in every color of the rainbow.
And we're trapped right now into doing another commercial for the top of the hour. Actually, we're coming on with the news in just a few minutes with our guest, Nicholas Pearson, Stones of the Goddess, Crystals for the Divine Feminine, Destiny Books.
In my own thing, for I'm on a mission for the King.
Stay connected with stimulating talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM, Baltimore, and WCBM.com.